present Jamie D. from the Back to Basics Home Group in Butler.
Thanks, buddy. Thanks, B. Hi, everyone. I'm Jamie. I'm an addict.
Hey, Jamie.
Can we say this Serenity Prayer again? It's something I always like to do, I guess. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, the courage to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. I'm going to talk about some of my experience with the second step. I know whenever I first came to Narcotics Anonymous, my sponsor at the time, and who was actually still my sponsor, whenever I started asking about the steps and got interested in the steps, one of the first things he told me was, the second step's my favorite step. And, you know, I think that the reason he thought so and the reason that it means so much to me is because it gave me some hope that I didn't have to live the way that I was living anymore. And at first, first reading the steps and going through the steps and seeing the words like higher power and God and stuff like that really kind of scared me. I didn't know really what to make about all of that, if this was some sort of religious thing or what. But my sponsor helped me clarify a lot of that stuff real early. So I don't know. For me, the steps are kind of a process, and sometimes it's hard for me to talk about one without a couple of the other ones. And so I'm going to try to do my best to focus on the second step. I know somewhere in our readings, it talks about after that admission, that kind of honesty that we get with ourselves, or that I got with myself in the first step, it left me with a very empty, frightful feeling of not knowing what to do next. Kind of like, okay, like I have this this disease, and I have this this defective manner in which the way I which you know I live my life, and now I have absolutely no idea what to do about that. And to me, that was very, very scary because I had lived my entire life that way, and I believe I lived my life that way pretty much since the day I was born, and in some way, some form. So I think that reading that and just seeing that an entire community of people have felt that same way was very comforting to me. And going into the second step is very comforting to me, knowing that my sponsor had those same feelings, and that like my sponsorship family had those same feelings. And so to me, the second step gave me a lot of hope, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I had been going to meetings for some time whenever I started officially writing on my second step, and I didn't realize it, but I had been practicing the second step in my, in my experience. I had already been practicing the second step. You know what I mean? There's, I believe, and I don't limit myself to like one power greater than myself. There's a lot of powers greater than myself that are here that can benefit me, that can help me in my recovery, that can help me in my life. And actually, as time went on, I've come to realize that all those powers aren't even necessarily in this program. I've gotten real close to my family and to friends outside this program because this program has given me like a life that like I don't have to live defectively anymore, and I can actually develop and maintain relationships with other human beings, inside this program and outside this program. So it's nice to know that I can go to like my family and some of my other friends and stuff like that, and I can talk about the things that are in my life, the things that are going on and the problems that I'm having. I never knew how to do things like that. Someone told me once that whatever process or whatever medium I take to get from the first step to the third step is my second step. You know what I mean? And that really helped me to put things kind of in perspective. You know, I talk a lot about the triangle of self-obsession and how the steps help me not stay in that for a long period of time. And so whenever I apply that first step to my life, you know, even today in situations, you know, whether it be, you know, another human being or a situation or whatever, it still leaves me, you know, when I get honest with myself about something, or when I realize that I'm trying to control something that I can't control, it still leaves me with an empty feeling, a feeling of not knowing what exactly to do about that. So I need a power greater than myself to help me get to the third step, to help me get to some sort of understanding with my higher power so I can be okay with what's going on. And so, like, I use a lot of things. I pray. When I first came to Narcotics Anonymous, like a lot of us, I had no understanding, no recognition of any type of higher power, you know, no type of God or anything in my life. And I actually feel fortunate that my understanding of that has been forged entirely by the 12 steps of Narcotics Anonymous. And the second step, for a while, I like way overcomplicated it. Like, I tried to make myself someone that I'm not, and I didn't need to do all that. I tried going to church for the first time in my life, and that wasn't for me, and like I was like real confused about that. And even though my sponsor kept pounding into my head, it doesn't have to be like that, I didn't understand, you know what I mean, that like what I'm doing right now, like when I call my sponsor, for me anyway, when I call my sponsor, when I talk to my support group, when I get into a meeting and I share honestly and openly about what's going on in my life, I'm practicing the second step. I'm using a power greater than myself, and hopefully, if I allow it, it can restore me to sanity. You know what I mean? It doesn't say, the power greater than ourselves will restore us to sanity. It says a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. And I think that when I get caught up and when my life becomes unmanageable, even though I'm clean, because it does often, I need to step back and I need to apply these steps to my life. And what usually happens to me is I get like caught up in a situation where I try to control something that obviously I can't control, and I try to control someone or make someone do something that I want them to do, or make a situation come out the way that I want it to come out. And obviously, what happens is I become angry, because when it doesn't work out the way that I want it to, to some degree, it causes some anger in my life, and that's, you know, that's my kind of way of dealing with the present in a defective manner. You know what I mean? That anger leads to resentment, and that resentment and that inability to control creates a lot of fear in my life. You know, when I'm not applying these steps to my life, and when I'm not learning about how to use them in my life, I'm a very fear-based person. That's what I go off of. And so, what I've come to realize is, when I can take the steps and when I can utilize them to get out of that triangle of self-obsession, that anger, resentment, and fear, I can live in today, and I can live just for today, and I can enjoy my life a lot more. And it's not that complicated, you know what I mean? Like, at some point, hopefully, you know, I realize that the thing that I'm trying to control, or the person that I'm trying to control, is not for me to control. I become honest with myself. I have this recognition. I have this honesty with myself. And like I said before, when I take that knowledge that I gain in that recognition, in that honesty, in the first step, and I allow a power greater than myself to kind of help me work through it. You know what I mean? I call my sponsor. I'm like, man, you know, I'm all messed up about this. I don't know what to do about this situation in my life. And I talk to my sponsees. I talk to my support group. I pray about it. You know, and prayer is real big for me. It wasn't for a long time, and I learned a lot about myself and a lot about my higher power. And I think as I started to get into like the third step and stuff, once again, I was real confused about what that all means, you know, what that all means to me and stuff. But whenever I take that stride and I go through and I utilize a power greater than myself and allow it to restore me to sanity, it makes the third step, you know, a lot easier. It makes my understanding of what my higher power would want me to do a lot clearer, you know. And so I learned a lot about how to communicate with my higher power, and I learned a lot about what I expect from him and what he expects from me. But I know in my life today, whenever I get balled up and whenever I need something in my life to help me, I have a lot of resources that I can go to. I have a lot of things in my life that can help me, you know what I mean, that can help me be restored to sanity, because I can get real crazy in my head, and I can get real defective in my way of thinking. And so I think that the most important thing for me to realize about the second step is that it doesn't have to be all about, you know, I have to be open-minded enough to let, you know, powers greater than myself into my life. I have to allow that process to work. I have to be listen to what people are saying. I have to be willing to go to a meeting and share openly and honestly with people, and maybe not even necessarily like in an NA meeting, you know, because to be honest with you, there's some things I'm not going to go share about myself in an NA meeting. But I have a real close-knit sponsorship family and a real close-knit support group that we get together and we talk about things that are going on in our lives. We talk openly and honestly and truthfully, and doing that has made me a different person. It has allowed me to become in touch with a power greater than myself. It has allowed me to be vulnerable and put myself in a situation to where I care enough about another human being that I'm willing to share with them what's going on in my life. And to me, all that, you know, has to do with the second step, has to do with having hope that this process can benefit me in some way, benefit me and the people that I love and care about. And I think that my understanding, my recognition of what the second step is or means to me has grown and has developed, and at this time in my life, I have a power greater than myself that I believe to be loving and caring, and that I pray to and stuff. But I don't limit myself to that. I think that the first power greater than myself that I felt in this program was clean time. You know what I mean? That when I was in detox, man, and I went to my first NA meeting, and I seen these people getting up and getting 30 and 60 day key tags, and I was blown away by that. And I know a lot of people come and say that they didn't necessarily believe that these people were staying clean and stuff. Well, I did. I think I did because I had to. I don't even know if those people were clean. I hope they were, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter at the time. That was the first hope that I really had, because I heard these people talking, and it sounded to me like they had, you know, been through and experienced some of the same things that I had, and they were staying clean. And I was blown away by that. I wanted to know how to do that. And so I think that was I tell my sponsees, and my sponsor told me, you know, some people were, you know, embarrassed to go up and get the key tag or whatever. I say, hey, man, a key tag's not for you. That's for them, you know. And it was for me. You know, thank God someone did that for me. I learned a lot. I learned a lot about prayer and about my higher power and about being restored to sanity, and made a lot of mistakes since I've been here, and since I've not used drugs, and I've cheated on women. I've dated multiple women at the same time, and I'm not proud of that stuff, but I learned a lot about what it means to be restored to sanity, and what these steps can do for me, and not only not using drugs, but growing up and becoming a man and not being a scared little boy anymore. And the second step was a big part of that, a huge part of that. Without that, I think it says somewhere in our readings that sometimes we can kind of just breeze over kind of that second step. And without, you know, sharing it, and without a sponsorship family, and I talk a lot about sponsorship because it's, to me, the backbone of this program, and it's what allows me to have any type of understanding of the steps, you know what I mean? And so, like, that second step and that power greater than myself, however it works in my life for that situation, has allowed me to grow up and become a man and understand what it means to respect myself enough to respect another human being, enough to love myself and to love another human being, and to not do things, hopefully, that are so defective to myself that are gonna affect my family and the people that love and care about me and stuff like that. And I don't know. That process of making mistakes and being ashamed of some of the things that I've done and going through that stuff in my steps has really taught me a lot about myself and about what it means to be in recovery and what it means to try to set an example for other people and stuff like that. So I think that's all I got. For me, the second step gave me initially a lot of hope that I didn't have to live the way that I was living. It let me know that I didn't have to wake up sick every day. And today, it still gives me those things. It still allows me to understand those things. But it also gives me hope that I can live a happy life and be able to love other human beings and be able to be a man and know what it means to be a man, you know what I mean? And so, you know, without that, I wouldn't be here, you know, without a power greater than myself, without you people here to listen to me and to help me get through my life and to teach me whenever I make mistakes, and to love me, even though I do make mistakes, I wouldn't have a chance. So that's all I got. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Jamie. All right. Our next speaker is Cheryl from Frick Park. Thank you.
addict named Cheryl. So, right about now at my home group, they have finished doing the reading of Tradition 8 out of the It Works How and Why and are getting ready to share. So it was funny. You know, I texted one of my home group members this morning to say that, you know, while they were meeting, that I would be doing this and thinking about them and talking about them. So I said, tell everyone I'll be talking about them. And it almost seems funny now that I'm speaking on the second tradition. I actually went over to programming yesterday to find out what time and where my sponsee was speaking. And they said, oh, yeah, and while you're here, we've got a couple spaces here that need to be filled. So I wasn't supposed to be speaking this morning. But it seems right because I should be sitting at my home group. You know, one of the things as I'm thinking about, you know, the second tradition, there is but one ultimate authority. No, that's backwards. I hate when I do that. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Really often need to think about that as, like, almost two separate concepts. And why it seemed really appropriate for me to be speaking on this morning while my home group is meeting is I walked into my home group about 3 weeks ago. Our secretary resigned, and I'm doing some setting up at my home group, and two of my home group members do one of these kind of motioning me to come over, and I'm like, uh-oh, this is not looking good. You know, you get that feeling, and so they kind of said, you know, we were thinking, and we're wondering what you think about this. We were going to nominate you for secretary. What do you think about that? And I'm like, I don't think about that. I was not thinking about it. I have recently completed a two-year service commitment and was really kind of looking forward to being a member. And so I really was not thinking about being an elected trusted servant again. So, okay, so now they've asked me, and I'm thinking. And then 2 weeks later, it came to light that our GSR relapsed. So now we have no secretary, no GSR. And so now I get approached by another member who's thinking that it would be nice to nominate me for GSR, and I'm thinking, okay, now I'm, like, screwed, is what I'm thinking, okay? Because, like, I'm not getting out of a service position at my home group, apparently. And then, of course, I call my sponsor, who pretty much said, yeah, I don't think you're getting out of a service position at your home group. You know, what I was thinking about in that whole thing of, okay, it appears that I will, in some way, shape, or form, in the next 3 weeks, end up with a service position at my home group, is that idea about being a trusted servant, that that people in my home group approached me about this because they trust and believe in the way that I have done service. And, you know, that meant something to me. And the idea, you know, and it was like the idea of actually being able to go back and serve at the group level again is kind of exciting for me. Yeah, so I was really kind of thinking about that as all of this was happening. So last night, I'm all about the literature. So anytime I'm asked to share on a topic, I go to the literature. But last night I was kind of tired when I was going to the literature. So I did something a little different, and then this morning I did something else a little different. So last night I kind of opened up my It Works How and Why. I don't know how you guys deal with your pieces of literature, but my pieces of literature are very colorful. And I'm a firm believer that, you know, like, if you're not making, you know, reading it and marking it up and doing all of that, that you're, like, shortchanging yourself and anybody else who happens to pick up your book. But then things get really kind of funny because, you know, I write stuff in it and I'm like, what the hell did that mean? you know. So the thing that stood out to me while I was looking through this, though, last night, was that I wrote, conscience equals reflection of relationship with higher power. And, you know, made me think about on a personal level that when I am acting in good conscience, my acting in good conscience is a true reflection of the well-being of my relationship with my higher power. If I am not in harmony, in good relationship with my higher power, then I have no conscience. I act in ways that are not becoming of a young woman in recovery, or an old woman in recovery, for that matter. When I am in a healthy relationship with my higher power, I do things with a good conscience. And so I was thinking about, you know, how do we bring that to the idea of the group conscience process that brings, you know, the ultimate authority into it. And oftentimes, you know, I think about decisions that have been made at my various home groups over the years in the name of group conscience. Anybody ever been, you know, at the recall group conscience meeting because last week's vote didn't work out right? You know, and I laugh about that because sometimes I think, you know, like a lot of times, you know, we joke about it didn't turn out right and that, like, somehow, like, because I didn't get my way, that means it didn't turn out right. But I think back, you know, years later, retrospectively, is that oftentimes when I think about some of those group consciences that a group of people said didn't turn out right, they didn't turn out right, and it had nothing to do with who got their way or who didn't get their way. But truly, how well was a loving God invited into the process? How well did each person sitting in that group conscience meeting maintain a conscious contact with their higher power to bring that level of honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness into the process by which we make our decisions? And while I was sitting there, I was thinking, you know, so often we forget the enormity of what group conscience can mean in Narcotics Anonymous. So, you know, so I'm at my home. I'm going to be at my home group. We're going to have our monthly group conscience meeting, and we're going to make some decisions. We've got to elect a GSR. We've got to elect a secretary. We have to determine how much literature to buy. And we have to make some decisions about some things that are upcoming in our area. We have to actually make a decision as to whether or not our home group is staying in the area that we're currently in or moving to another area. We might be called upon, if somebody actually brought all of the information back, to make some decisions that impact the region. And then come, you know, next February, we'll be making some decisions at my home group that then combine with the decisions at each of your home groups, that combine at the area, that combine at the region, to make some decisions that impact Narcotics Anonymous as a worldwide fellowship. And I think sometimes we forget that. We forget that the process goes beyond our backyard. And so while I was sitting there looking at my book, my well-colored It Works, How and Why book, I think about the process by which this book was written and the process by which a lot of our literature is written. And when I think about group conscience working in its entirety, I really think back, I get to remember that I shared in the process of this. And I get this image, every time I think about this, I get this image of about 300 addicts at the I think it's the Grand Ballroom at the Weston William Penn. in 1992. And we all had our draft versions of the It Works How and Why, which we used to jokingly and lovingly call It Works When and How Much. Because, I mean, this book was published in 1993, and as a fellowship, we started working on this book right after we finished the basic text. But I remember being in, like, this place. First of all, I had, at 92, I had, I don't know, coming up on 5 years clean, to be in the Weston William Penn. You know, not the Motel 6. You know, not the, you know, we got no bed bugs. With 300 other addicts in the grand ballroom. And like, this process by which, you know, we all had these, you know, because everybody had an opinion, right? So we all had our little our draft guides that we had put all of our stuff into. And, the literature committee decided that we were going to divide up into tables of 12. Imagine that. And that each table was going to workshop a step in a tradition and kind of go through and look at what was in the draft and go through this process. And that each table kind of had a group conscience of what we liked and what we didn't like and what we wanted to see changed. And you know, somebody was the secretary and recorded all of the stuff. And that then we kind of came together and somebody shared, you know, from each table about, like, what we, you know, what we thought. And that information kind of went on because those kinds of activities were happening all over the world. And that then, you know, I don't know, 6-8 months later, we actually had this book, and it was like, wow, like that we were able to invite a loving higher power in to influence that process and to come out with a piece of literature that, you know, most of us have on our bookshelves, or like I keep mine in the back seat of my car, just amazes me that we're able to do that. Worldwide. You know, and then I think about, you know, so when I think how successfully we were able to do that, and then often how unsuccessfully a home group can decide whether to be smoking or non-smoking, whether to start at 7 o'clock or 7:30. You know, like, we do really well with some of, like, the big stuff, and that little stuff we just, you know, we just start to struggle with. You know, some of the other things that somebody rolled over onto their car keys. Some other things that kind of stood out as I was looking over some things in my little notes was this idea, you know, World Services started talking about this concept of consensus-based decision-making about 5-6 years ago. And people were in an uproar. What do they mean, consensus-based decision-making? What do you mean we don't take a vote and, you know, 51% wins? And it was like, that wasn't, you know, maybe the term was new, but the idea of that was in our literature at least from 1993. And it says, solutions to problems become apparent. Solutions that take into consideration the needs of everyone concerned. In developing a group conscience, a clear mutual understanding or consensus arises. Based upon the understanding gained by sharing group conscience, a group may move on to a vote in order to make a decision. In the best of circumstances, however, the group continues discussion until it reaches unanimity. The resulting solution may be so obvious that no vote is needed. You know, that we talk about things until everybody's question or concern about the potential decisions are addressed, and then we make a decision. And that doesn't, you know, I'm one of those people people that know me are going to be nodding. I'm always right. In case you didn't know, I'm always right. Or at least I think I'm always right. I know that I'm not always right. I can defend all that. Like, I came from a house where I was always wrong, and so now I always, you know, whatever. Who doesn't, anybody out there not want to be right? Okay, see, you know. Then my sponsor taught me this little thing that I was supposed to ask myself. Would I rather be right, or would I rather be happy? And for the first 3 years that my sponsor asked me that question every time, I said, well, Andy, of course, I'd rather be right. And she just looked at me like, oh, my God, I got a lot of work cut out for me here. The idea of being able to talk about things until we can make a decision is not that it ends up that you're right and I'm wrong. What it ends up is that we make a decision that everybody involved can live with and can follow through with and be committed to. And that often has what we call some give and take, some compromise, but that, you know, sometimes what I think is best for me and what you think is best for you is mutually exclusive. But the more that we talk about it, we can make decisions that appear to be in the best interest of everybody. And it doesn't mean that any of us get 100% what we want. But we get what is going to best meet the needs of the many. And I think the other piece that comes into that and really why it is so important that we have each invited, you know, a loving higher power into that is that oftentimes what we have to think about in those decisions is not even what's best for all of us sitting around here right now, but what's best for the addict who hasn't walked in the door yet. What's best for the addict in Bahrain where there's two meetings? You know, what's best for the addict in some country that doesn't even have an NA meeting yet? And that being able to talk about being able to put the self-centered nature of our disease aside for a minute and think about, you know, what's best outside of our own backyard. You know, I think a lot of the conflict and a lot of the controversy that comes up in our fellowship comes from whether it's our individual self-centeredness, whether it's our group self-centeredness, whether it's our area self-centeredness, whether it's our region self-centeredness, is that even as an NA service body and the people that contribute to that body, that we don't think beyond our own needs. Like, we don't think about the addicts outside of our immediate vicinity. And sometimes we need to do that. You know, when I think about the idea of, you know, how do we invite that loving higher power in? You know, and I always like to think about that, you know, particularly as it comes here in this tradition, that idea of God as that acronym, good orderly direction. Like, when it comes down to it, you know, and it's one of those, a loving God. Now, my loving higher power might be a very different loving higher power than somebody else's. But if we're all inviting whatever it is that we believe in into our hearts and into our spirits when we sit down in that process of group conscience, what should come from that is that idea of good orderly direction. That the group can make a decision that's based on moving in a positive direction towards solution to a problem rather than staying focused in the problem. I've belonged to a variety of home groups that have done things very differently. But for the most part, over the last, I don't know how many years, I've always belonged to a home group that did an inventory process. And each of those groups have done it differently. And that's probably the most serious and difficult of group conscience processes to go through. To be able to look at your group from an outside and, like, answer the questions, you know, are we fulfilling our primary purpose? Are we reaching all of the addicts that we could in our immediate vicinity? Is there something about our meeting that makes it attractive to newcomers? Is there something about our meeting that makes it unattractive? Are people showing up? You know, the best way to know whether your group is being effective or not is, are people who stand up for a one-day key tag coming back to your group and standing up for a 30-day key tag 30 days later and a 60-day key tag 60 days after that? And if they relapse, are they feeling safe to come back and pick up a one-day key tag again? And then a year later, are they standing up for a year? You know, it says, you know, key tags are a good way of taking an inventory. If you're always running out of one-day key tags, but you're not running out of 30 days and 60 days, that means people are coming and getting a one-day key tag, again, not coming back. You know, we don't always think about those things. Little bit, I guess, back on being a trusted servant. You know, it's one of those things that's interesting. You know, it says our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And then we spent, I don't know, 2 or 4 conference cycles talking about what leadership means in Narcotics Anonymous. And what does it mean to be able to have good leadership qualities in Narcotics Anonymous? And what it means is to have some skills that allow us not to take ego on and to be able to recognize that, you know, when I'm in a leadership position in Narcotics Anonymous, that it is not about self, but that it's about service. And that's a tough role. I can speak for myself. For me, that's a tough role because I have an ego. I can lack humility. I can think that I know it all. I remember being a GSR, oh, God, this was a long time ago, at the old Laurel Highlands area, which was not up here in the mountains but was kind of down there in the valley. And as a GSR, during a discussion, I made a motion. So I made the motion, obviously, without my group because it was, you know, on the floor of the area service meeting. And I made the motion, and the motion got a second, and then it got tabled back to the agenda for the groups to vote on. And damn it, my home group did not vote against the motion that I made. Now, talk about, like, first of all, let's start with there's a struggle. Like, I made a motion, so I believed in what I was putting forward, right? So, of course, I want to vote for the motion I made, right? But my group's conscience was no. So I had to carry the vote of no. I had to vote against a motion that I was the maker of. Did that not feel weird? But I had to do it. Because my responsibility as a trusted servant, as a GSR, was not to carry out my will, but to carry out the will of my home group. And, you know, over the years of serving in various different service positions, you know, I have had to do that. I have had to vote against what I thought was right because I was carrying the conscience of a group, whether it was a group or an area or subcommittee. You know, there's been times when I remember when I was the RCM for the Northeast area, and you know, you have your areas. I had my areas, you know, vote of confidence to make decisions on the floor because sometimes, you know, there's a motion on the floor, it goes back to the areas, it goes back to the groups, and then more information is presented at the time that the vote is taking place, and the more information, like, I had to be able to think about, based on this additional information, do I think, knowing the way my area thinks, would they still want me to vote the way they sent me with the vote, or would this additional information change that? And I remember multiple times thinking that the additional information would or wouldn't change it and whatever, and I voted accordingly and got back and reported how I voted, and they were like, that's not really what we would have wanted to do. And so there's that balance of being able to represent and understand the general tenets and beliefs of the people you represent. And that can be a very, you know, precarious place to be in. And I always, you know, for me, it was always about being on the up and up. Like, always keeping track of how I voted on something and bringing that back to the people I was representing so that they could tell me whether they liked the way I voted on their behalf or didn't. Now, I guess I want to talk a little bit, and then I'm going to shut up, about what I've learned about, like, applying the traditions outside of Narcotics Anonymous. Because oftentimes, a lot of people don't talk about how these principles work for us outside of here. And it's far easier to apply, all right, it's still hard, but it's much easier to apply them in here with a group of people who are trying, at least, to apply these principles. But I try to practice these principles, you know, the 12th step talks about practicing these principles in all of my affairs. And so I like to try to take what I learn in here and practice it out in, you know, the rest of my life. And when I think about, you know, what I do as far as my employment, that I know that the organization that I work for has a primary purpose, and that when I'm in any kind of committee meeting, team meeting, anything, you know, on my job, that whether other people are inviting a loving higher power in or not isn't any of my, like, I can't tell them what to do, but I try to step aside and ask, you know, my higher power to help me to influence, you know, my decision. I try to have a conscious contact so that the decisions that I'm making and what I'm sharing in that environment is done not out of self-will, but out of a connection to, you know, my higher power. And I try to, you know, I'm in a leadership position in my employment, and I try to remember, you know, every day when I go to work, that I go to work not to be, you know, the big cheese, but that I go to work to serve the consumers where I work. That the decisions that I get involved with, I have to think not what would serve me best, you know, because what would serve me best right now is a 3-day work week with a full pay. But that's not going to serve my employer well. I've tried to convince them of that, but they're not going for it. You know, and then I have to think about, you know, how does every decision that I make impact other people around me? You know, the other area that I really have to think about this, you know, and try to apply this, and I don't always do it as well, is like in my family. Yeah, my family's over there nodding. You know, I like to think that I'm the boss in the house. Even the dog, I am the alpha dog. The dog knows that I am the boss. The dog, honestly, the dog is the only one in my house that really believes that I am the boss. And the only reason why the dog believes that is because, like, I give the dog his food. I take the dog out for his walk. All right, some of them do help sometimes. But only when I remind them to. But the dog knows who the boss is, right? none of the rest of them know that I think I'm the boss, but I'm not. That, you know, my family functions best. It will function. We function dysfunctionally. But we function best when a loving higher power is invited into the decision-making processes. And, you know, I can think about over the, oh my goodness, last 13 years of my marriage and the last 15 years that my husband and I have been together that, you know, 90% of the crap that we have experienced, we've experienced because one or the other of us did not engage in group conscience. And went off making decisions self-centered and half-cocked, and forgot to invite a loving higher power in. All right, maybe 95% of those bad decisions happen that way. That using the tools that I've learned in here, you know, in all areas of my life, improve all areas of my life. What a concept. How does that happen, right? Living by some spiritual principles. So I'm going to end with some of the spiritual principles because I like spiritual principles. That's like one of my favorite things about this book is I love that in the traditions we have that applying spiritual principles, like I can just key in on, you know, damn, you can almost always go to the first or second paragraph in applying spiritual principles, and it just tells me that some of the principles that seem important in tradition two include surrender. Surrender doesn't mean giving up. Surrendering, for me, as it applies to this tradition, is really about letting my will go and kind of encompassing the will that comes out of the group conscience. Then it looks at the next spiritual principle is faith. I don't know about you, but I had no faith in anything before I got here. And sometimes, you know, in that surrender to the group conscience, that the faith that I have is not always that the decision that we make is going to be right, but the decision that we make is going to lead us to learn what we need to learn. You know, I always think about some of those group conscience decisions where, you know, in January we make this decision and, you know, in June we unmake it. Well, sometimes we needed to make that decision so that we could learn what we needed to learn. And, like, the faith that I'm able to have today is that whether the solution ends up being right or wrong, that the lesson is learned. And that becomes really important to me. The next principle it looks at is humility. And humility is like that interesting concept because how do you talk about humility and be humble at the same time? But, you know, I've come to learn that humility is truly just about being able to accept myself as I am with my assets and my liabilities. And being able to admit them publicly, which sometimes feels more humiliating than having humility, but it isn't. You know, and then it goes on to looking at open-mindedness. And being able to think that somebody else's solution just might work. Or that somebody else's take on the problem. All right, I'm going to talk about that for a second. I have this sponsee, or maybe I don't have this sponsee. I'm not really sure right now. Who gets confused about what it means to ask for help. And I can talk about this because I had this problem for a long, long time. Okay, so, and I had to teach my child this one, too. So if my shoes are untied, that's probably a problem, right? It's especially if I'm walking around and I keep tripping over them. And I can keep saying to everybody around, I got this problem, my shoes are untied. Hey, David, I got this problem, my shoes are untied. Hey, Lou, I got this problem, my shoes are untied. I know what the problem is, right? And I think that by just telling everybody that this is the problem, that I'm asking for help. I'm stating the problem. I'm living in the problem. I am not in any way, shape, or form saying, can you help me find a solution to my problem? That humility is about being able to ask for help and not just live in the problem. And so often, I think, sometimes we get bogged down in the group conscience about repeating the problem. You know, everybody goes around and repeats the problem in, you know, 20 different ways that we can say this is the problem. And thinking that somehow that's going to beget the solution. Rather than, okay, let's all agree that this is the problem, and now let's go around one by one and say, you know, I don't care how out of the box, how off the wall you think your solution might be, throw it out there. Brainstorm it. The more we talk about possible solutions, the more open-minded we are to the way of resolving it, the more likely we are to come up with a resolution that we can all buy into. But if we just all keep walking around saying, you know, my shoe's untied, my shoe's untied, well, I'm going to be tripping over my shoes. Nobody's giving me Velcro because I haven't asked for help. Nobody's saying, Cheryl, bend your ass down and tie your shoe. Or, all right, pick your foot up and I'll tie it for you. You know, that we can live in the problem and not be open-minded to the solution. The next spiritual principle it lists in here is integrity. And, you know, a simple thing about integrity is meaning what I say and saying what I mean. It's saying I'm going to do something and following through with it. It is living my life by the set of principles that I say I live my life by. And doing that, check this out, whether you're looking or not. Integrity is not what I do when everybody's looking. It's easier to do the right thing when all eyes are on you. But am I doing the right thing when nobody's looking? Because I don't know about you, I was always about what can I get away with. All right. I always had this belief that nothing was illegal unless you got caught. Integrity is about doing what's right, doing what's legal, doing what's moral by my morality, not necessarily by your morality, whether somebody's looking or not. You know, so I try to you know, do that. And anonymity. And I love that word. And I love how we've complicated the concept of anonymity. You know, the dictionary says that anonymity is the state of bearing no name. You know, when a book is published anonymously, it's published by somebody who doesn't put their name on it. You know, when somebody makes an anonymous donation to an organization, it's that there's no name on it. We get so caught up, this is my pet peeve. When we end a meeting and say, who you saw here, what you hear here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Please don't. Because if you leave what you heard here, you shouldn't have even come, because you got to take it out of here and use it. Okay? Now, you don't have to say to anybody, so, you know, I was at the meeting last week, and I heard Cheryl sharing about blah, blah, blah. You know, like, you don't have to dish my personal dirt that I shared here. But if you came away from what I shared with something that helps you in your recovery, by all means, spread it. Spread it like jelly on bread. Spread it. Or peanut butter, because I like to gob the peanut butter on more. Anonymity is that it doesn't matter whether I stand up here with 30 days clean or 30 years clean, that what I have to say is of equal value. That all of us have the same value in Narcotics Anonymous. That it doesn't matter whether I've ever had a service position or I've never had a service position. It doesn't matter whether I've sponsored 200 women or I haven't sponsored any women. That we are all equal in here. And that what we each have to say is of equal value. And that really brings me kind of like back around to that idea of the group conscience. Is that in that group conscience process, what each of us has to say is of equal value. And that we are all open-minded to each other. And that when we are able to invite that loving higher power in, we make decisions that are in the best interest, not only of ourselves, of our group, of our area, but of the fellowship as a whole. And with that, I'm going to shut up. Thank you.
All right, I'd like to thank Cheryl. Can we please have the reading of We Do Recover? Or just for the day.
That's wrong one.
Good patience. Adding me, David.
Tell yourself, just for today, my thoughts will be on my recovery, living and enjoying life without the use of drugs. Just for today, I will have faith in someone in NA who believes in me and wants to help me in my recovery. Just for today, I will have a program. I will try to follow it to the best of my ability. Just for today, through NA, I will try to get a better perspective on my life. Just for today, I will be unafraid. My thoughts will be on my new associations, people who are not using, and who have found a new way of life. So long as I follow that way, I have nothing to fear.
Thanks. All right, can we please form a circle and finish with this?